Hello, I'm Rachel Marshall, editor at the Cochrane Editorial Unit. Welcome to the September 2011 monthly roundup from the Cochrane Library. This issue includes 36 new and 37 updated reviews, and we feature 5 of these reviews in this roundup. They examine fortification of foods with micronutrients for young children, antiemetics for vomiting in acute gastroenteritis, ways to help people to remember to take their tablets, repairing water-damaged buildings for preventing chest conditions, and oral analgesics for acute postoperative pain. The review on analgesia for postoperative pain is also the subject of an editorial on the Cochrane Library. Christopher Eccleston, coordinating editor of the Cochrane Pain Palliative and Supportive Care Group and director of the Centre for Pain Research in Bath in the UK, writes about this landmark publication of an authoritative Cochrane overview of more than 30 separate Cochrane reviews of oral analgesics. Also on the Cochrane Library in September is an editorial on a new web-based health and nutrition resource from the WHO called the WHO Electronic Library of Evidence for Nutrition Actions, or ELENA. Hannah Neufeld and Francesco Branca from the Department of Nutrition for Health and Development at the WHO in Geneva, Switzerland, write about the purpose of this new resource and why they think it will be beneficial. You can read both editorials at www.thecochranelibrary.com. But turning to this month's podcasts. The first of our featured Cochrane reviews examines home fortification of foods with micronutrient powders in children under 2. The review was funded by the World Health Organization and is available in ELENA. Luz Mario Duregil, also from the WHO's Department of Nutrition for Health and Development, describes the review.
Exclusive breastfeeding is recommended to feed the babies during the first 6 months of life. After this time, babies should start receiving semi-solid foods, but in many countries, their diet might not contain enough vitamins and minerals. In fact, it has been estimated that approximately half of the infants and children under 2 across the world have one or more deficiencies, particularly of iron, vitamin A, and zinc. These nutrients help children to grow, fight infections, and maintain their cognitive and physical capacity, so it is important to ensure that children have sufficient to avoid the short and long-term consequences of these deficiencies. There are several strategies to control vitamin and mineral deficiencies. A recent one, which we investigate in this review, involves the addition of powdered vitamins and minerals to homemade baby food to improve the baby's diet without actually changing the food that they eat. This process of enriching or fortifying the food can be done at home or at any other place before eating, and so, it is known as home or point-of-use fortification. The micronutrient powders are usually delivered in a small single-dose packets, which are given to the mother to sprinkle on her baby's food. Currently, several countries are considering the implementation of large-scale projects using micronutrient powders, and they need reliable information to guide their programs. That's why our review assesses the powder safety and effects on children's nutritional status and health, and compares this intervention with iron supplementation, which is a standard practice in both the clinical and public health fields. A group of experts and international stakeholders help us to select the critical outcomes for decision making, and we also wanted to explore how the effects of the micronutrient powders changed according to their iron content, frequency and duration of use, and how well they work in places where malaria is endemic. We included 8 trials that together involved almost 4,000 children aged from 6 to 23 months from low-income countries in Asia, Africa, and the Caribbean. We considered that most of the trials were of good quality. To be eligible for the review, a powder had to contain at least zinc, vitamin A, and iron, but all the powders tested contained between 5 and 15 vitamins and minerals, and they were usually given on a daily basis for 2 to 12 months. We found that the use of micronutrient powders containing iron, zinc, and vitamin A reduced the risk of anemia by about a third and half the risk of iron deficiency when compared with a placebo or no intervention. However, there was little or no evidence that this intervention had an effect on growth, survival, or other nutritional or developmental outcomes. No deaths were reported in the trials, and information on side effects and morbidity, including malaria, was scarce. The micronutrient powders produced similar benefits on anemia and iron deficiency to iron supplements, but were associated with fewer side effects. However, Very few trials compare these two interventions directly, and so it's difficult to draw strong conclusions. In summary, our results suggest that in places where iron supplementation programs are not in place or are not successfully implemented, the use of multiple macronutrient powders for home fortification of foods is a valid option for preventing anemia in children aged 6 months to 2 years. Our search strategy also identified several ongoing trials, which will double the body of evidence in approximately 2 years, providing additional information on the beneficial and adverse effects of this intervention.
Staying with children, childhood vomiting is a distressing experience for both the child and their parents. Ben Carter from Cardiff University in Wales is an author on the latest in a regular series of updates of the Cochrane Review, which assesses the effects of antiemetics when the vomiting is associated with acute gastroenteritis.
Acute gastroenteritis is a common illness in children and adolescents. It's due to an inflammation of the intestines and is the main cause of vomiting in young children. Every year, 200,000 children under 5 present to emergency departments in the USA, and there are about 24,000 hospital admissions in the UK due to acute gastroenteritis. In updating this review, we have found promising evidence for an effective treatment which might ease the burden on children, their parents, and the healthcare system. As well as being distressing for children and their carers, vomiting caused by acute gastroenteritis can lead to dehydration and other problems, including irreversible shock, intractable seizures, and kidney failure. For mild cases, standard management is oral rehydration therapy, which is effective for the majority of children. But for moderate to severe cases, vomiting limits its success and leads to an increased need for hospitalization and intravenous rehydration therapy. However, treatment of vomiting in children with acute gastroenteritis is controversial, with a lack of agreement on how to use medication to stop the child from vomiting. Our Cochrane Review was first carried out more than 6 years ago to resolve this uncertainty, and now, in its third update, it looks as though the drug ondansetron might be effective. Our update includes 7 trials with just over 1,000 participants. The studies recruited children up to the age of 12 and randomly allocated each child to one of 2 or 3 groups, which included at least one antiemetic. 6 studies were done in emergency departments and 1 in a community practice setting. 4 antiemetics were examined across the studies: ondansetron, dexamethasone, metoclopramide, and dimenhydrinate. These were administered in a variety of ways, with 1 study using rectal suppository and the others giving the drugs either orally or by intravenous injection. Due to the heterogeneity in the designs of the trials, we limited our pooling of results to trials that investigated a weight-dependent dose of oral ondansetron versus placebo. 5 of the 7 trials had a high risk of bias, and the risk of bias was unclear for the other 2 studies. Most studies were at risk of bias because of the loss of data on participants, as well as other factors, including the problems that can arise when a study is funded by a pharmaceutical company with a vested interest in its results. Looking at ondansetron versus placebo, there was consistent evidence from all 6 studies of an increase in the proportion of patients who stopped vomiting after receiving the drug. There was a reduction in the immediate hospital admissions, the need for intravenous rehydration, both during the stay of the emergency departments and after 72 hours from following discharge, whereas there was no significant difference noted in how often the children had to go back to the emergency department. However, oral ondansetron was found to be associated with an increase in the episodes of diarrhea. Our review adds to the evidence supporting antiemetics for vomiting due to acute gastroenteritis in children. At the moment, clinical practice guidelines recommend supportive care using oral rehydration therapy for mild to moderate dehydration, but provide no recommendations on the use of antiemetics. However, it appears that there is an increased tendency towards prescribing of these drugs by clinicians. Our review suggests that ondansetron given to children with mild to moderate dehydration decreases the number who have continued persistent vomiting, which is a barrier to oral rehydration therapy. In addition, as well as increasing vomiting cessation, the drug decreases the number of children requiring intravenous rehydration and immediate hospitalization. We conclude that there is clear evidence to support the effectiveness and likely cost-effectiveness of ondansetron as a means to stop vomiting, reduce the need for intravenous rehydration therapy, and reduce the need for hospitalization. On the other hand, there is evidence of an association between ondansetron and an increase in diarrhea. Many gaps in the research remain to be filled. There is a need for more trials of drugs other than ondansetron, and most of the studies conducted to date were carried out in the USA, in emergency departments, and tested oral ondansetron. Well-designed trials are needed in other countries and in community practices, and to investigate and compare other routes of administration.
Cochrane reviews highlight the beneficial effects of many different medicines for a variety of illnesses, but we also know that lots of people don't always take their medication exactly as it was prescribed. Kamal Martani, from the Department of Primary Healthcare at the University of Oxford in England, is one of the authors on an updated review looking at the effects of specific types of packaging to help people to remember to take their tablets as prescribed.
Adherence to medication is a major challenge in healthcare, and studies have found that only about half of the people given medication actually take it. And other research has shown that poor adherence to medication is associated with worse clinical outcomes. Strategies that improve medication adherence are therefore of great importance, and we need good evidence on what will help and what might be a waste of time. In this update of our Cochrane review, we show that reminder packaging makes it more likely that people will take their self-administered medications over a period of a month or longer. Reminder packaging includes a range of ways to assess a person's medications, such as a pill box, blister pack, bottle, or single-use container that incorporates a system that provides a reminder for the day or time when the medications are to be taken. Updating the review led to the addition of 4 trials, bringing the total to 12 studies. But the number of participants nearly doubled and now stands at almost 2,200. This provided us with additional data and power for the meta-analyses, and among the studies that reported adherence, we found that the presence of a reminder packaging aid improved medication adherence by an average of 11%. We also found that patients preferred the reminder packaging, and interestingly, one of the newly added studies from the United States reported that preference for reminder packaging was highest in the lowest literacy group. Medication taken after exposure to reminder packaging also seemed to have an effect on some clinical outcomes. For example, in patients with high blood pressure, those taking medication in the presence of reminder packaging had a significant improvement in their diastolic blood pressure compared to those in the standard packaging group. However, we didn't detect a difference in their systolic blood pressure. There was also some evidence that reminder packaging may be of health benefit to people on diabetic medication, although we felt that the overall quality of the trials for this analysis was not high, and so we are cautious about the strength of that finding. Nevertheless, taken as a whole, reminder packaging looks like a simple, cost-effective way of improving medication adherence and certain clinical outcomes. There is still a need for more high-quality studies to confirm this, and we look forward to incorporating these into future updates of this review.
Although most Cochrane reviews look at the effects of treatments that are taken directly by people, some, such as a new review from a team of researchers in Finland, examine the impact of other types of interventions. The review assesses the effects of the renovation of water-damaged buildings on the respiratory problems experienced by the people who live and work in them. Ginny Hetherington from the Cochrane Collaboration Secretariat describes the review.
Many people have personal experience of staying in a water-damaged house and the effects this can have on sneezing, coughing, or a running nose. It can also cause more serious symptoms, and research has shown that mouldy buildings increase the risk of upper respiratory tract conditions, such as asthma and asthma-like symptoms, like wheezing. This new Cochrane review was done to determine if renovating or remediating buildings damaged by dampness or mould would reduce or prevent respiratory tract symptoms, infections, or asthma. It found low-quality evidence that this might be the case. Exposure to damp buildings occurs in three different ways. People might be exposed where they live, they might be exposed at their workplaces, and when public buildings are water damaged, both workers and the public can be affected. For example, this might happen with teachers and children at school, or nurses and patients in hospitals. The Cochrane researchers included both randomized and non-randomized studies in their review, as long as these had evaluated the effects of renovating and cleaning buildings on airway symptoms. They found 8 eligible studies with just over 6,500 participants, which had been done in a variety of buildings. There were 3 randomized trials and 5 other studies, but they found it difficult to interpret the findings of these non-randomized studies. It's also possible that exposure time in the school studies may have been too short for an effect to arise, and the detection of effects in children depended on accurate observation by parental respondents, which might not have been achieved in some studies. The interventions that had been assessed aimed to remove mold and dampness from family houses, schools, or, in one study, an office building. When remediation of houses was compared to no intervention at all, the review found evidence that interventions that targeted mold reduced asthma-related symptoms and respiratory infections and decreased the use of their medication by asthmatics. One study examined the effect in children of a program of extensive remediation compared to a provision of information alone and found that the number of emergency and inpatient visits decreased after the repair work, but no difference was seen for the number of days on which the children had asthma symptoms. In another study, pupils' visits to physicians due to a common cold were less frequent after the building was repaired, but respiratory symptoms like stuffy nose, runny nose, dry throat, hoarseness, and eye irritation were similar before and after the intervention among both the pupils and the adults who worked in the schools. The wide range of outcome measures and variation in the study designs made it difficult to draw hard conclusions within the review. However, the authors conclude that the results do suggest that if people staying in a mold-damaged building have more respiratory symptoms than usual, a thorough remediation might prove helpful. Although, to prove this conclusively, they note the need for better research, including the use of validated outcome measures.
Our final feature this month brings together a collection of systematic reviews on drugs for treating post-operative pain into one document. Andrew Moore from the Nuffield Division of Anaesthetics at the University of Oxford in England describes the finding of this Cochrane overview.
In order to show that a drug works in acute pain, we give it to someone who's got moderate or severe pain after surgery or having wisdom teeth removed, and then measuring how the level of pain falls over the next 6 hours or so. The basic design of studies to measure the analgesic effect of drugs in acute pain was developed as long ago as the 1950s and 1960s. Trial designs were rigorously tested at the time, and acute pain trials were amongst the earliest to demonstrate why randomization and double blinding were important. These trials have stood the test of time and detailed examinations of their methods at several times subsequently. In Oxford, we've been looking at the evidence in acute pain for drugs classed as analgesics in the British National Formulary. There are now 35 separate Cochrane reviews, with 38 analyses of oral analgesics tested at different doses in acute postoperative pain. About 45,000 people took part in 350 individual studies. What we've now done is to combine all of the reviews into a single overview. The first finding was the variability of the amount of evidence. Now, the good news is that for 46 drug and dose combinations, like paracetamol 1,000 mg or ibuprofen 400 mg, we had reliable results which we could trust. However, for 35 drug and dose combinations, there were either no trials or inadequate data or such limited data that we couldn't trust it. The second finding was the variability in effectiveness. While no drug was 100% effective in everyone, some drugs were highly effective, providing good levels of pain relief to as many as 70% of patients. These included newer drugs like etoricoxib and combinations of drugs like ibuprofen together with paracetamol. Others were much less effective. For example, paracetamol at the common dose of 1,000 milligrams gave good pain relief, but only to about 40% of people. The other message was that the more effective drugs also tended to last longer. What makes this overview valuable is that it provides a one-stop shop to professionals who want to make their practice better, or policymakers who want to provide guidance to improve pain treatment in a particular context. Improving pain treatment is not a trivial matter. There's a lot of pain about, even in hospitals, where it often goes either untreated or inadequately treated. Ordinary members of the public might also want to use the overview as a quick check on the analgesics they buy from the chemist for their everyday pains. In actual fact, few over-the-counter drugs appear in our results, largely because in the past, companies never felt it necessary to publish clinical trials. Historically, that is still a problem. What we've done, though, is to establish what is known and also what we need to know for the future. That gives us a very solid foundation on which to build for a future that hopefully will include much more effective acute pain management.
You can read this Cochrane Overview and all the featured Cochrane Reviews, along with the dozens of other new and updated Cochrane Reviews in the September issue at www.thecochranelibrary.com. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening to this September 2011 roundup of the Cochrane Library.